Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Paul Williams.
Thank you. Wow, time travel. And
only 40 years.
See this beautiful face ravaged by the forces of time?
I think you've done pretty well in 40 years.
It's stunning to watch the film because of just the amazing performance, of Bill Finley. To convey the breadth of emotion from just this total innocent to, just this rage and terror and all, with one eye showing. I mean, it's just stunning to me,
Now, I want to ask you something. I read that when the film was being conceived, there was originally talk that you might do that role.
Brian talked about this kind of weird little guy up in the rafters who was the Phantom, who was throwing things on people. He said, you could do that. I said, I can't do that. I'm not scary, And I mean, I just knew I couldn't do it. I also didn't want to play somebody. He'd come to me first for the music. And so as we're working on the music and I'm talking about what we're going to write, what I'm writing, whatever, he kind of was watching me. He said, what about you doing that? And I said, no. I also didn't want people I didn't want to play somebody whose music was stolen. I thought, people are going to go, oh, he thinks his music's stolen. He's getting back at the record industry. And I said, let me play the guy who steals the music. I don't know who said it first, but when he said play Swan, I went, yeah, the clothes are going to be better. The clothes are really... I thought they were so hip at the time. Get me Rosanna Norton on the phone. It's a period piece. It wasn't a period piece when we did it.
That's what
we were supposed to look like.
And, of course, the studio was originally going to be called, or the label was going to be called Swan Song.
Of course, there were the problems because somebody else owned the title, and there's all the weird graphic, the electronic graphic floating in front of podium in front of lecterns and the like and all, but and the other thing I noticed is my weight is I think I was thin and I kind of had it together for the start of the movie and then started eating. There's a craft service, so there's actually one scene where I go into the I think it's the Thursday. Today is Thursday scene where you see me walk up. And it's L.A. I go inside for the Thursday. Today is Thursday, and I think we were in New York for that. And then we cut to. That's for on Winslow. When you come back around to cut on me, it's in Dallas or in New York. At any rate, it was by then I had gained 15 pounds or something. Then I walk out and you see me leaving 15 pounds thinner like that. It's just, it's amazing. Of course, the ego, that's what I'm sitting there watching going, oh, my God. Porky, nice looking. Porky, nice looking.
So tell us what your original talks were like with Brian De Palma about this project. It's such a you get to work in so many different styles. It's amazing.
That's what was the fact is I was known for the kind of Hallmark card lyrics and the Carpenters and Three Dog Night. It was so very different from this, and it was thank you. But my favorite band ever was the original Delaney and Bonnie and Friends, and I loved just all kinds of music. But what came out of me was kind of this ballads sort of. Ouch, mommy songs. I've been writing codependent anthems my entire life, pick me up and love me songs. But the original thought was that it was called Phantom of the Fillmore, and it was a very straight send-up of Phantom of the Opera. But as we worked on it, and the interesting thing about working with Brian is that he was just so open to the script evolving, and it was a time when, with the Vietnam War, we're sitting watching the war news.
Right.
Eating our TV dinners, and it's like this horror story is becoming entertainment. You know, we're watching the news like it's the evening's entertainment, the footage from Vietnam. And that sort of started to move its way into the story. You know, my favorite line in the movie is an assassination coast to coast on live television. That's entertainment. I mean, I love that line. I love what it says about what the film kind of morphed into. And then the other thing was the fact that I looked like, you know, I was 34 then. I'm 72 now. I love saying that. I'm 72. I feel like a really tired 37, you know. But I think I looked, you know, with the long hair and the kind of the Haley Mills look-alike period that I was in. I think that he jumped into the idea of the Dorian Gray thing, and it evolved. You know, I wish I had a copy of the original script so I could tell you how far it really changed. I find that the longer I live with it, that it turns out that I probably had less to do with the changing of the script than I thought I did. I think that as you mature and you look at somebody's genius and you kind of get a larger global view of what happened, I just look back on the experience with just extreme gratitude for working with Brian and just the brilliance of the cast. As I said, Bill Finley, George Memoli, who's so good, who passed away, has gone also. And Jessica Harper, there's just one quick story about... We were casting, Brian and I were casting in New York, and the, you know, girls were I had everybody sing, long ago and oh so far away, I fell in love with you before the second show. The great Leon Russell song, which was kind of like where I wanted, I thought that would be one to show the voice, because I was starting to work writing Old Souls or had written it. But so I wanted them to sing something that they knew, and Jessica was singing to herself. I walked up behind her, and she was going, "Our love, long ago and oh so far away, I fell in love with you before the second show." And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, just this wonderful voice. And then she came into audition for Brian, and it was like, long ago. And I said, you know, no, sing it to yourself like you did out front. And I think that's kind of where that moment in the film, you know, came from. But she was just stunning, you know.
Yeah. What's your feeling about the reception of the film? I talked in the beginning about how it was kind of a surprise, how poorly it did initially when it came out. And you've lived with it over the years. I'm sure people come up to you all the time and talk about it.
You know, I think one of the things, the reason people love the film as much as they did is because everybody else just so totally dismissed it. You know, I think that there were a lot of people that I meet that they have a kind of a sense of ownership about the film, you know. There were little girls who would come up to me and say, you know what, that's amazing. That thing about the story about he sold his soul to the devil. Did you make that up? And I'd be like, you know, there was this whole, you know, that we kind of, that sort of pre-existed, you know. But hold on, hold that for just a second.
Sure.
I absolutely have to clean my glasses.
Okay.
They're totally, totally glaring in the light, and I want to see everybody out there. But yeah, they make me crazy. I'm sorry. You know, you get to a certain age, you take care of your own comforts immediately. You know, you know, it's odd because I don't know why. You know, God bless the Winnipeg and God bless the Peggers, because you know it became a gold album because of Winnipeg. You know. But the other city. Yeah.
So, what was your explanation about that? Because
there is no, you know,
a few years ago, there was an event called Fantapalooza. In Winnipeg, right?
And if you watch the Alive, Paul Williams Still Alive, the documentary, the first scenes in that are at Fantapalooza, where Steve Kessler, the filmmaker, followed me up there. You know, I think that we've talked about it. It's interesting because the film was hugely successful in Paris as well. Paris and Winnipeg, there's so much alike, you know. Let's explain that. I think that I was such a kind of a non-threatening, you know, I find that a lot of the people that really fell in love with the film in Winnipeg were young girls of a certain age. And I think that the kind of archetypical, you know, immense drama of this great story, you know, was new to a lot of them. These elements that our old stories were new to them. I think that I was very kind of androgynous and non-threatening. You know, I could kind of be the cute little guy on the screen that, you know, that was not threatening. The quick honest answer is I don't know why it was. I know that the thrill of the picture for me is being able to satirize all the different kinds of music that I love so much.
Talk a bit about how you do that. This is something also that it's a little bit different than what you're doing at Ishtar, but there's a way that you're satirizing the music, but it's catchy. It's like terrific, and you're also satirizing at the same time.
Well, I'm a huge Beach Boys fan, you know. So doing it was great, you know, to take Faust and whatever the initial song was and warp it into a Beach Boys sound. You know, carburetors, man, that's what life is all about. You know, the lines in it, like, you know, of all life's mysteries, the greatest one I've seen. Tell me why my short run's better when it's clean. We've all had that experience. Your car seems to run better when it's been washed. I love the Beach Boys. The creating the music of the spheres, the kind of stuff that was for the big final scene and all, was just, you know, trying to find something that had just a great feel to it. I had great musicians. And there was a guy named Ray Kennedy, who I loved. I loved Ray's voice. The one thing I'm a little... There are two times in my life that I have dubbed an actor's voice. And both of them I regret. There are two times that I really regret. One is every now and then, in the middle of the night, I kind of go, you put somebody else's voice in Jodie Foster's mouth, in Bugsy Malone. And I go, oh, my God, I should have let Jodie Foster sing her own songs in Bugsy Malone. And when I listened to Ray Kennedy, or when I listened to Garrett in the shower, that's Garrett's own voice, you know, life at last. And it's so close. I went, you know what, you should have let him do his own vocal on Life at Last. And, but it's too late to change it. What the hell? You know, but yeah, I loved Ray Kennedy. I just tried to attack it with humor and with great musicians. You know.
Yeah. Let's open it up and take a few questions from the audience. So right over here, and I'll repeat them so everybody can hear. Has there been consideration of turning this into a musical?
So many times, before I die, I'm hoping that sometime within the, I don't know what kind of years I'm gonna manage to tack onto where I am right now, but I would like to think that before I hit room temperature, I'll get to see this on stage, because I think it's a natural. We tried to do it back in the late 80s. You know, the late 80s were an interesting time, and I wrote some additional songs for it and all. The late 80s were an interesting time for me because those were the Ishtar years. I wasn't really in my body in those years. You know, I just, this March 15th, I'll celebrate 23 years of continuous sobriety. So this was pre-hardcore alcoholism work.
It wasn't Ishtar that led you to
Ishtar
drink.
Ishtar was kind of in the Ishtar. I was, by then I was, you know, well, you know you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. I misplaced the 80s. You know, it's one of those things where I went, you're telling me that Reagan was president? Oh my God, that's amazing. How did it? But I think that there was the question was about making a musical out of it. There has been conversation about it. It's liable to happen someday. I know that I'm ready, and there's some additional material written. I think that Brian feels the same way. That when the right situation comes up, when the checks are drawn, and the opportunity is there. So far, in about 23 years, it hasn't happened. But since we've been talking about it, maybe it will.
Okay, over here.
You'll have to leave now.
I was a 9-year-old boy living in Winnipeg.
Yay.
The movie was coming to town. I was too young to see it. So my mom bought me the paperback and the album.
Wow.
So thank you for that. And I have two questions. First off, what happened to the wardrobe? And secondly, how did the Hell of It Brady Bunch thing come about?
Okay, so what happened to the wardrobe, and then how did the Hell of It Brady Bunch thing come about?
Because I was such a media whore by then, I just, you know, all you had to do was ask me, and I would show up. I always said, if you put down, that's really what the movie Paul Williams Still Alive is about. is because I just, you know, I after Phantom and, all of a sudden I was doing The Tonight Show all the time. I mean, it was like a once a month kind of a, I did The Tonight Show 48 times. I remember six is the way to describe it. But, but yeah, it was just, you know, they had asked me to do a Brady, that special. And what do you want to do? I don't know if it was their idea or not, but they wanted me to sing the hell of it, or I suggested singing anything to get people to have some awareness of the movie and try to get some bodies in the seats, which didn't really work very well in those times. But, well, I don't know what happened to the wardrobe, but I'm sitting with Tracy Jackson, who is my writing partner. We're writing a self-help book about recovery, and the only thing that was a mild distraction for the movie is every now and then she would go with the shirt. Where does that shirt? Look at that outfit. You know, so I sat there while she made fun of everything I wore on.
Okay, more questions?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, if anybody wants to. Oh, okay. So she was asking what films were influences to Brian De Palma.
Well, I think he was a huge, huge Hitchcock fan. Yeah. I think that's been clear through the years and all. The recreation of the shower scene was amazing. Incidentally, somebody should share with you something that during the all that concert footage and the shower scene, Garrett Graham had like 104 degree temperature. He was so sick he couldn't hardly walk. Right. And in the midst of that, maybe do you remember that? He was just so ill and you know, would go back in his dressing room and just lay there and like near death and then get up and do that amazing performance and all. So a side note, just I'm a huge, huge fan. He's so good. He steals the film. He's amazing. But I think that Brian had a real love affair with Hitchcock. He had a great sense of moving camera. There's a shot in there. I don't know if you know the one I'm talking about, but the shot where the Phantom gets his costume. That's Ronnie Taylor, the camera operator, who later became a cinematographer and won the Oscar for Gandhi. Mm-hmm. It was him with carrying a camera on his shoulder because there was no Steadicam yet. Going up and down those stairs again and again and again to get the shot so it would end up with the camera, with the mask over the camera and all. It's just brilliant camera work. You know, it would be a great question for Brian, and I should have probably said at the very beginning of this long answer, I don't know, you'll have to ask Brian.
Okay, right over here.
That's, I think, the last thing Rod Serling ever recorded was The Swan. He has no other name, yeah.
Your performance was like, I don't know if it was informed by Twilight Zone episodes or characters within Twilight Zone, but...
So, yeah, he's...
Something so understated about
thank
it.
Thank you.
And when you see the reflection where you sign the devil, where you sign your soul to the devil, I just want to know what informed...
Could you talk about your performance? Because there's something very understated and sort of sinister.
My favorite scene, as far as my performance in the film, I'm really proud of the bathtub scene because you see Swan before he became, you know, Swan, you know, inhabited by, you know, by the big, ugly, downstairs guy, you know. But I think that my thought was that the devil, if Swan is in fact, you know, an incarnation of the devil, that he would have to just be so charming and so slick, you know, and... I think the performance really begins for me with Swan's reaction to, you know, when he's finally has the knife to his throat as he comes out and there's Winslow and he's like immediately just, you know, we've been looking for you everywhere. He's just, you know, he's just so slick and charming and so evil, so lovingly, you know, beautifully evil. It was great to play him, but the best scene for me, the scene that was so exciting to do was the scene in the bathtub where you see this guy, this sick little guy who's just afraid of getting old, you know, and you hear what he sounded like then, you know. It was just great fun. I appreciate the compliment. Thank you. I wish you wrote for a major newspaper.
Oh, do you remember where? Yeah. Could you?
Like, did Brian say, hey, watch, I don't know, you know, Lost in Space?
Yeah, no. How swathy was? No, not really. Brian doesn't work, you know, it's really unfortunate. I mean, I would love it if Bill, who made so many films with Brian, could give you a much better input about that. But Brian, I don't remember Brian giving any of us a lot of direction. I think that his amazing work is in creating a story and a script and an environment, you know. And you have to understand, I had such a massive especially then, an ego that was a little out of balance. I was in the middle of my what I really want to do is direct period. I remember walking up to Brian. We were shooting at the Majestic Theater in Dallas, and he's moving the camera up to shoot footage of me up on the balcony, and then he's moving the camera down to shoot something I did. He's going back up here, and I walked up and I said, you know, any idiot would know that if you put a Chapman crane on the stage, all you have to do is swing the arm back and forth, and Brian's lining up a shot without even looking away from the shot he was lining up. He said the stage won't support it. Chapman Crane. And I went, okay. I went back into the little, you know, dressing room and sat down and went, just keep your mouth shut, Paul, you know. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. I think that he had a relationship with Bill Finley and with the other actors and all that was possible. You know, there were moments that you watch a director like him or like, you know, some of the guys that I worked with through the years, the best ones will take an actor and it's a private moment between the two of them. So he never sat at the back of the room and said, Jessica, you need to be this or you need to be that. If he said anything, I think he probably took her or me aside and said quietly, this is getting a little big, maybe want to tone it down a little, or you know, or his verse. Every actor, every director has their way of saying two words, louder and faster. You know, it's like louder and faster, louder and faster. Don't take a moment with pass the salt. Pass the salt. You know? You're asking for salt. Pass the salt. You know?
So do you still want to direct?
No. I have an amazing day job. 4 years ago, I was elected president and chairman of the board of ASCAP, and it's been the most amazing honor of my life is to have a chance to. There are two things I'm intensely passionate about. I'm passionate about my recovery. I speak often at a public level about my recovery, and incidentally, it's, my drunkologue is very boring. I never came out of a blackout with a Russian arms dealer. I never came out of a blackout with a Norman Mailer and a couple hookers in Paris. I'd come out of a blackout at the boys' department of Sears, you know, trying on sweaters, but I'm passionate about recovery, and I'm passionate about creators' rights, music creators' rights, film creators' rights. As we've moved into the digital age, you know, it's amazing. If I pay something to have delivered more promptly from Amazon, I have to pay more money, but they can get my songs like that or your films like that online and stream it, and they want to give you pennies instead of dollars, and it isn't fair. And I want all of the people that are downloading music or streaming music, all the kids that are sitting looking at this world in their little rectangle of their computers, I want them to know that we don't want to shut any of that music off. We don't want anybody to be fighting for the music. We don't want to take anything away. We don't want to control the internet. What we want to do is what was done in radio, which made such amazing sense, is that radio gave you the music free. And then they sold advertising. And the songwriters and the publishers and the composers got a little tiny percentage of all that advertising income. And that's what has to happen. That's what needs to continue to happen in a larger fashion in the internet. We want the music to keep playing. We want there to be enough of an income in it to make a viable living for the songwriters, for the composers, and please God, for the filmmakers. And the film composers have an especially difficult time right now with the new digital world. So it's wonderful to be able to, when somebody, you know, sits down in front of me and puts a microphone in my hand, I will always take an opportunity to say, please, you know, have a sense of what is fair to the songwriter, the filmmaker,
the creator.
It's amazing.
May I say thank you for this amazing honor of sitting here and being able to talk about my four different films and four different nights? What an amazing honor for especially when two of the films are films that even my family didn't go to see. Ishtar.
We're the ones who are going to say thank you to you for being
thank
here.
Thank you. So. Thank you. It's really great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, we're going to see you back over the weekend. I said there's a surprise with Ishtar. We can't say who's going to be here, but she directed the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And wrote it. So come back for that tomorrow. There's some real treats along with the Muppet movie.
The Muppet movie, incidentally, for the Muppet movie, Craig Sherman is here right now. He's going to be here tomorrow. Kenny Asher is going to be here with me, who co-wrote all the songs for the Muppet movie. So if you come back, we can talk about Kermit and Gonzo on My Best Friends.
And we do have a piano over here. So.
There's a piano over there. If Kenny's with me, I might even do it too.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.